You are looking live at downtown Moscow. That is our studio that you're looking at right there. We bring it here from time to time because we want to give you a sense of what's going on in this most important city. It's a beautiful city, to say the very least. But, you know, it's funny, and I've always believed this, and the longer I live on this earth, the more I understand this. A place is not a place because of the place. A place, or what makes a place good, is the people who live in that place. And I swear, if you are fortunate enough and get a chance to come to this city, you'll see that the people here are what makes this a good place. Just, you look at them. You look at them walking around. They're happy. They're content. They like their government. They like their country. They're very family-oriented. It's a whole different kind of vibe than you get in a lot of places right now in the world, and certainly especially in a lot of Western cities. So it's great to be in a place that's also at the crossroads of a big news story. The government of Russia and a representative from the government of the United States has been here, right behind me over there in that building that's part of the Kremlin and where Mr. Putin holds meetings from time to time. And he was meeting today with a dignitary from the United States. And we're going to be telling you all about that because it is something the whole world is watching right now. This is Sanchez Effect, and let's do this. Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to start this show today by helping to set the scene for you. Here is the present situation insofar as Ukraine goes. Now, even though I just said Ukraine, I use the word Ukraine, what we're going to be talking about is not dictated by Ukraine. Why? Why? Because Ukraine is really a proxy. It's a vassal state that is being used right now by NATO and the U.S. because they want to damage Russia. And they're going to use Ukraine to damage Russia. That's the truth. The truth matters. It matters in this case. So that's accepted by most people who watch this and study this situation. So given that, what is the decision that NATO and the United States have to make? After all, remember, it's really, again, it's all about them. This is not about Ukraine. It's a war between NATO and Russia, the U.S. and Russia. Ukraine is just like the middleman, right? Here. Let me go through the choices. These are the two choices. When you really narrow this down to its concept, to its core, these are the two choices that I think and that are generally accepted to be the terms for Washington, for example. They can choose to end the war tomorrow, if they wanted to, by simply accepting Russia's terms, or they can continue the war indefinitely at the expense of Ukraine. Their decision right now is pretty clear. They want to prolong the war at the expense of Ukraine, its people, its territory, and this is important as well, at the expense of Ukraine's negotiating position moving forward. Listen to this.
Well, I'll be clear by stating this administration does not want a quick fix. This administration wants a long-lasting, enduring peace in the region.
There it is. Did you hear what she says? So let me translate it for you. When she says no quick fix, she means no quick end to the war. And when she says long-lasting peace, take out the word peace, put in the word war, because that's what she's really saying. She really means long-lasting war. Wars are good for people who want to make money from wars. What does the United States derive most of its money from? Wars. Wow, what a surprise. You don't have to go to MIT or be a genius to figure that one out, right? That's that lady, by the way, that's a deputy spokesperson for the U.S. State Department. In other words, a hack or a flack, as we who are journalists usually call them. It means somebody who simply is given lines to read or talking points, and she really doesn't even know what the hell she's talking about. It's just something they gave her to read. And if that's the position of the State Department, by the way, which it clearly is, then why are we seeing this picture right now? Look at this. This is today in Moscow. That is Steve Witkoff. that you're about to see shaking hands with a smiling Vladimir Putin. Mr. Putin's always willing to talk to anybody, it seems. Mr. Putin, just today at the Kremlin, was expecting Mr. Witkoff, and there he is. Witkoff is a billionaire real estate investor who is a friend of Donald Trump's from his New York days. Witkoff is not a diplomat, not a negotiator, likely comes in knowing little to nothing about the nuances or the history of this conflict, of Russia, or of Ukraine, for that matter. So here's the key question, right? If Witkoff is simply in Moscow to parrot Mr. Trump's position, and Mr. Trump's position is Russia should stop fighting right away, allow the Ukrainians to rearm, allow the West to pour more money in, allow for no security guarantees for Russia, allow for no relief from sanctions, and allow Ukraine to become a part of NATO. If that's what Mr. Witkoff is bringing to the table, you kind of have to ask yourself, what the hell did he get on a plane and come here for? And by the way, you also have to wonder if this is nothing but a show, you know, a kabuki dance, right? Because that ain't going to happen. Just ain't going to happen. Especially when you consider that Russia has already offered a deal and it was refused by the West, right? Remember Boris Johnson? Also, that Russia's military is gaining more and more ground with each and every day. It's also getting stronger and more sophisticated as an army with each and every day. Also, the confidence of the Russian people, these people behind me in their government, is growing every day. Statistics show it. So do polls. Meanwhile, the people of Ukraine, man, it's ugly. They're taking to the streets. They're no longer convinced they can win the war. They're demonstrating against corruption. They're demonstrating against the war. And there's this. Look at this. Look at these scenes. I mean, this is crazy. Scenes like this are repeated daily in Kiev. I mean, authorities are assigned the task of going into communities and targeting men who look like they could be used in the military. No matter their age, they find them, they chase them, they grab them by force, and then they lock them in vans to be taken away to the front lines. But lately, as you can see, the people are fighting back. People are coming out of their homes when they hear a whistle, and they attack the police officers and these recruiters. And in some cases, like this one you're looking at here, the guy gets away. They were actually able to free him. Can you imagine? They're also reporting helping the Russian army. Yeah, the people of Ukraine are helping the Russian army by giving away the position of Ukrainian recruitment centers so the Russians can target them with missiles so that they can't recruit their family or loved ones. You know, you look at this, you see that, and is there any wonder why Ukraine, you know, they want the fighting stopped? I mean, think about it. When you're losing territory, when you're running out of soldiers, when your own people are rioting over government corruption and they're applauding the Russian missiles and attacks, of course you want to start over. Time out, let's start over, right? Time out, let's do a redo, as we call it. That's what I would do if I was playing a game of golf or football with you and you were destroying me. I'd say, can we start over? Can we do a reset? Sure. The answer is from Russia so far, or from Mr. Putin, yet. No, we're fine, thank you. We're not going to stop. Not until you at least negotiate with us and talk about some of the things that we've been wanting to talk about for 3 years now, if not more. So that's kind of where we are. I mean, and by the way, who wouldn't want that? I mean, if I was Ukraine, I'd say, yeah, let's start over. And if I was Russia, I certainly would say, no, we're not starting over. But, you know, it's what Mr. Trump seems to be saying he's going to do. And if not, Russia and all the countries who are friends with Russia are going to be punished with a 500% tariff. And Mr. Trump just announced, as a matter of fact, that he's going to put a tariff on India. He's going to punish India for being friends with the United States. So far, India is saying, look, we choose our friends. You don't choose our friends for us. What is this, high school? Right? But that's where we are. Now, if you really want to understand the situation of Ukraine, You should talk to somebody who's been on the inside. And you know what? That's, guess what? Exactly what we're going to do. By golly, when we come back, we're going to be joined by a former colonel of the SBU. You know what that is? That's the security service of Ukraine. Stay right there. This will be good. We're going to learn a lot. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is the Kremlin that you see behind me. As a matter of fact, it was a very important place today because the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, was having a meeting today with Steve Witkoff, the envoy sent by Mr. Trump to meet with the president of Russia to try and see if they can figure something out regarding Ukraine. By all indications, we don't think anything was figured out. But obviously, we're going to follow it for you. And as we get more information, we're going to share it with you. Now, I promised you this, and I'm excited about this. The man that you're about to meet, he has seen it all in Ukraine. From 1999 to 2018, he was part of the SBU. I mean, those are the security forces of the country. He was a lieutenant colonel and considered a senior consultant expert as well. Colonel Vasily Prozorov is joining us now, and we want to welcome him to the Sanchez Effect. How are you, sir? Good to see you, Colonel.
Eric.
Thank you so much.
Nice to meet you.
Likewise. So let me start with the question a lot of people would ask. It must have been very difficult for you when you made your decision, because I'm sure you love Ukraine, you love your country, when you made a decision that you were going to leave Ukraine and essentially fight against its government. How hard was it to make that decision? Why did you make that decision?
Let's start with the fact that I didn't leave right away. After 2014, after the Maidan, I spent almost 4 years working in Ukraine while also collaborating with Russian security services. And I left Ukraine back in 2018, late December 2018. Why? Because I was under threat of arrest and torture, so I had to leave in a scramble. I spent 4 years after the Maidan working at the main apparatus of the SBU of Ukraine, at the anti-terrorist center, which led the anti-terrorist operation in Ukraine. Hmm. And I was an eyewitness of what Kyiv was doing in the Donbass and how the Ukraine was rapidly becoming a Nazi state.
So what you're saying is that you witnessed people in your government in Ukraine attacking its own people, attacking the Ukrainian people, right?
Absolutely.
Right, that's what it was. The anti-terrorist operation, that's what they officially called it, in the Donbass, was launched in April 2014. The first time I came to the zone, in May, near the town of Slavyansk, which saw some of the most landmark events of that period of time. And I saw it with my own eyes, how the army didn't want to fight, was reluctant back then, because officers and soldiers knew they were fighting their own people.
Huh.
But the Kyiv authorities were pushing the military. And several weeks later, the army began to bomb its own cities, began shelling them with artillery and tanks. And it all happened in a matter of several months. So active fighting near Slavyansk started on the 2nd of May 2014, but on the 2nd of June 2014, a month later, the Ukrainian aviation was bombing the peaceful city of Lugansk. They struck this downtown area, killing 7 people, and about 28 were wounded, including women, old people, and kids. It was just a month later, and after that, it all went downhill. What went from bad to worse, the army became like a punishing force.
You are a Ukrainian who happens to be a colonel. That's no small rank in the military. So you've seen a lot, you had a lot of authority. And you're telling us a story that is contrary, if not the opposite, of what the whole world has been told. The world has been told that Russia just willy-nilly decided to go into Ukraine because they're bullies and they wanted to take over Ukraine. You're saying, no, Ukraine was first attacking the people that Russia went in to rescue. Did I get that right?
No.
Well, number one, my ethnicity is Russian, but that's not surprising because Ukraine is home to many ethnic Russians. It's a multi-ethnic country, and there were many Russians at the security service of Ukraine. It's not a secret to anyone. As for what you said about the story that the West heard, I saw that with my own eyes. You can't pull wool over my ears, my eyes with propaganda. I saw those Nazi battalions torturing people. It's not getting reported. Kyiv propaganda is hushing this up, but they were torturing their own citizens. During my work in the Donbass region, I was the head of the operational group of SBU in the town of Mariupol. The Mariupol airport had this dreadful secret prison called the library, as you probably heard. During my tours of duty in Mariupol, the library had about 200 inmates, none of them citizens of Russia, all of them citizens of Ukraine, and all of them were tortured by SBU and volunteer battalion fighters. What Russian aggression are you talking about? During the anti-terrorist operation, as far as I know, Ukraine was only able to come up with maybe 15 citizens of Russia who were captured, and 10 of them were probably Russian paratroopers who lost their way, and that's it.
Huh.
That's in 5 years of the anti-terrorist operation. So what Russian aggression are you talking about if they had almost no captive Russian soldiers? They can be counted on the fingers of your hands.
I've heard and read, Colonel, that my government, because I am an American citizen, the CIA worked with, recruited, and encouraged some of those people you speak of, the Nazis and neo-Nazis. I never believed there were really Nazis in Ukraine, but now I've learned from people like you and others, they really were Nazis in Ukraine and still are. But that the CIA knew they were Nazis, but they were useful to them. Because those Nazis hated Russia, the CIA hates Russia, so they essentially fed them, gave them funding, encouraged them, helped them grow, etc. Is that true? Did I get that right?
I'll tell you even more. Not just the CIA knew that there were Nazis there. The U.S. Congress was aware. In 2015, the U.S. Congress passed the decision to stop financing Ukrainian volunteer battalions, including the Azov battalion. It was a battalion back then. It's a prohibited terrorist organization because American congressmen said it loud and clear that they were an anti-Semitic neo-Nazi outfit. It's all on YouTube. It's all online. There are U.S. congressmen speeches in Congress where they said that, and the decision was made to cut the funding because Azov was clearly labeled a Nazi outfit. It's just that this is not getting talked about in the West, and the Ukrainian authorities don't like to talk about it these days. Back in May 2014, I saw it with my own eyes. I saw the SS signs on their helmets. I saw swastikas again on the helmets and the uniforms and tattoos. Nazis from all over the world flocked to Azov. It became a training camp for neo-Nazis from all over the world. Do you know that from the fall of 2014, Azov was the an official unit of the National Guard of Ukraine as a separate special purpose unit? So it's official. It listed 900 people. It included 900 people. So the National Guard of Ukraine paid their salaries, provided them with uniforms and armed them. But essentially, but in reality, Azov had 1,600 more people, like 2,500 people in total, and all of those people came to Ukraine unofficially, skirting the official chain of command. We can talk about a Nazi international of sorts. They flocked from all over the world to get military training with Azov, and they were part of that unit. They were sponsored by donors, they got uniforms, they got some kinds of sustenance. As for IDs, their only IDs were issued by the commanders of Azov, not by the leadership of the National Guard of Ukraine. Can you imagine how many years went through Azov in 8 years between 2014 and 2022? How many Nazis from all over the world trained there?
When you say Nazi, what do you mean? What do these people believe? What makes them or constitutes them as Nazis? Because when I think of a Nazi, I think in the United States, there's these guys, there's a couple of them somewhere, they have no teeth, and they're kind of meaningless, and most people laugh at them. Or we think of the real Nazis during the 1940s who were involved and were part of Hitler's army. So when you say Nazis in Ukraine, most people around the world are going, what's he talking about? Describe these people to me. What do they want? What do they believe? What do they think of? Who do they hate?
Well, for starters, they created idols for themselves. They idolized Nazi leaders of the 1940s. It's no secret to you, after Azov was routed in Mariupol and they surrendered, The tattoos of the Azov fighters included Hitler's portraits. They would tattoo faces, Hitler's faces on their backs and thighs, not just swastikas and SS emblems. They had Hitler's Skarzeny and Himmler portraits. That was their new fashion. They stylized their IDs to look like the Third Reich documents. Reichskommissariat Ukraine.
You saw that?
Yeah. Yes, I did. Again, go online. There are hundreds of thousands of pictures circulating online. Just Google Nazis in Ukraine. You will see millions of photographs, them doing the Nazi salute using swastika banners. I saw captured Donetsk People's Republic's prisoners of wars, and they branded swastikas with hot iron on their bodies. There's a whole file. The forensic experts in the Donbass have these pictures of those poor people after they were then returned back to the Donetsk People's Republic, and how they had been maimed and how they had branded swastikas.
Who do they hate? Jews? Catholics? Blacks? Russians? Who do they hate? If I'm going to form an organization, it has to have a cause. What the hell is their cause?
No, изначально, если копнуть чуть-чуть в историю,
Andrei Beletsky, the founder of Azov, was born in Kharkov, and he founded the Nationalist Socialist Assembly of Ukraine, which reflects the NSDAP, the Germany's Workers' Party. So there was a direct link, and they were talking about the purity of the white race, purifying the Ukrainian society from impurities of what they called second-rate races, like people from the Caucasus, blacks, Eastern people, all those who were not white. So they were white supremacists. And after the Maidan and the beginning of the anti-terrorist operation, their hatred for, let's say, people of different skin color transformed first into hatred for the residents of the east of Ukraine, and then hatred for Russians as a whole. And they don't care if it's a citizen of Russia born in Kaliningrad or Petersburg, like a really white person, you know, to use this term, or if it's a Russian citizen from Yakutia or from one of the republics in the North Caucasus. They don't care. Anyone who holds a Russian passport is an object of their hate, and no, there are no scruples, no moral limits. They would kill anyone, kids, women, old people.
So what if you... At the time, you were a person of authority. You were considered, well, you're a lieutenant colonel. That's a high rank. You had the authority to go to one of these guys and say, if you believe more in Hitler, who you have on your sleeve, and if you believe more in hating Russia and hating Caucasians and hating people from the Caucasus, pardon me, or hating other people, I don't want you in my military. Get the hell out of here. We're not going to make a country with people like you. We don't want you here. What would have happened if you would have said that?
You're asking all the right questions. And let me tell you, in May 2014, when I first visited the territory of the anti-terrorist operation, I saw the Ukrainian army. And having a swastika stenciled with a pen on the helmet, that would mean a blow to the head of that person who would have done this from his comrades and commanders. I'm talking about regular army. I'm not talking about volunteer battalions, which were initially full of Nazi ideas. But you can't imagine how serious the influence and the shadow power of those volunteer battalions was. Nobody could say anything to them. A simple example, in the summer of 2014, when I was working in Mariupol during another tour of duty, the fighters of the Shakhtyorsk battalion just thought that somebody was probably working with the separatists, and they captured the chief of police of Mariupol. They would just caught the guy in the street, they accused him of collaborating with the separatists, and brought him to Kyiv. There was something close to panic or shock in Mariupol. The head of the city's police, it's a big city, almost 500,000 people. So the head of police was just plucked off of a street, put in a van and shipped to Kyiv. He was released several days later. But do you think somebody was punished? No. Those fighters never got punished. There were instances of rape, burglaries, killings of business people, just because they wanted their businesses, or maybe they just like their cars. You know, they would just pull them over, kill the guy, bury the body in the woods outside the city, remove the license plates, and send the car somewhere back to Ukraine to resell it. And do you think anyone was punished? I can't remember any single court case against a nationalist volunteer battalion fighter for anything they committed during those years. So I can't imagine a situation where an SBU officer or a military prosecutor or prosecutor's office officer would walk up to a volunteer battalion fighter and to tell him, remove the swastika. That officer would have been punished much more likely. Let me just give you another example, if I may.
Okay.
Back in 2017, that was my last tour of duty. I was deputy commander of the anti-terrorist operation. I was responsible for all SBU units. And on May 9th, on Victory Day, you know, it's a holy, sacred holiday for Russians, and the sides agreed to a ceasefire between the May 8th to May 10th. Nobody was supposed to use mortars or artillery. But during May 9th, there was a rally in the village of Bezimine. It's a village in the Donetsk People's Republic. It was shelled by the Ukrainian side. About 80 shells were launched. There were people, civilians, who were injured. When representatives of the Donetsk People's Republic said, look, guys, we had agreed on a ceasefire, the Ukrainian side just said, we didn't shoot. They started an investigation. Who shot? So, Azov artillery shot. Military prosecutors decided to launch an investigation into those artillery units. They were apprehended, arrested, and they were brought to the HQ of the M sector in Mariupol. The M sector was responsible for the fighting around Mariupol, but when they were driving them through Mariupol, it's just like in a Hollywood movie. The column was pulled over, they blocked them from the front and the back on jeeps with machine guns, and the Azov removed their people from that column. They brought them back to their base, and they told the Ukrainian servicemen, if you meddle once again, we'll all shoot you. I have documents to back up this story.
So
it's a true story.
So you're saying the Azov, you saw with your own eyes that the Azov were more powerful and pulled rank, as we say in America, over the regular army. They told them, we're in charge, not you, don't you forget it. Yeah. And these people you are going to accuse of a crime, we're going to free them. Wow.
Another example. In the years of 2015, 2016, and in the Dnipropetrovsk and the Zaporozhye regions that are controlled by Ukraine, there was a series of crimes, very grave crimes, like bank robberies, attacks against cash and transit cars. There were about 12 or 15 instances like that, and those attacks were well prepared, including using a grenade launcher against a cash and transit armored vehicle. There were bank robberies using flare bombs, and the attackers were wearing military uniforms. In Zaporozhye, during one of the bank robberies, the police arrived on the scene, and two of the attackers started running away from the police. And you know what they did? They used a military grenade against the policeman, and one person had his leg torn off, and the attackers were never found because police with their pistols could not do anything against those guys with grenade launchers. Just a second, let me just finish. So at the end of the day, they were arrested, and they were Azov fighters. One was killed during arrest, two were taken prisoners, and two managed to flee, and they went to flee, and they hid out at the Azov base in Mariupol. Investigators from the police and SBU went there eventually to the Azov base and said, give up those guys, we need to do a search. And you know what they were told? They had machine guns pointed at them. No, you're not going to enter. The intervention by Minister Avakov.
That's power. Yeah, that's power. You know, it's interesting. Here's the irony. Here's the irony of this, right? I come from a country where if you even say something a little bit wrong that involves Nazis, you defend Nazis, you accidentally say something historical about Hitler, you lose your job, you'll never work again, you could be put in jail. If you don't defend Israel, you're put in jail. I mean, in the United States, the idea that anybody could have any kind of power and have a position that in any way resembles a Nazi ideology, that would be anathema. That would be horrible. You'd be ruined for life. And yet, here's the irony. Our government of the United States has been and is to this day encouraging Nazis in Ukraine. How in the hell does that happen? I mean, there's almost a hypocrisy to that, isn't there? I mean, that's crazy.
Well, I can tell you how I see it. It's just my personal opinion. You know, as long as these people are killing Russians, they can get away with anything. They can get away with Nazi symbols, with Nazi salutes. They can get away with anything as long as they keep killing the Russians. The West, wow. Unfortunately, the West puppet masters who are behind Ukraine are interested in this war because this war is hurting Russia. They don't give a damn about what happens to Ukraine. So whatever those fighters from the volunteer battalions are doing, they're going to turn a blind eye to that. Do you think the West doesn't see those swastikas? Under Poroshenko, there were Ukrainian soldiers brought to German hospitals where Nazism is outlawed, and Ukrainian fighters were not ashamed doing a Nazi salute in hospitals in Germany, and they had those tattoos with swastikas on their bodies. Do you think the Germans didn't see that? Of course they did, but nobody's going to talk about it, because right now these Ukrainians work for Western interests.
It's amazing. Yeah. And I don't know. It's just a crazy idea that just came to my head. But I, you know, I'm watching the genocide of Palestinians and how Israel is so damned angry at the Palestinians. And the people they should be angry at are the people in Ukraine. But that's another story for another day. Let's talk about now. Today, the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, right back in that building over there, welcomed the envoy from the United States. Now, the envoy of the United States is representing the president of the United States. I do not think, me personally, I don't want to put words in your mouth, I don't think the president of the United States understands the situation. I don't think he understands what Russia needs. I don't think he understands the nuance or the history of Russia and Ukraine. And I don't think that he is going to be able to find a deal that is workable between these two countries because of that. Do you agree with me?
To a degree, yes, but let me share my point of view. I think that Mr. Trump sincerely wants to end this war. But the thing is that he works against a very powerful lobby of sorts represented by people who have a vested interest in this war to continue, starting from the military defense lobby that makes billions upon billions of dollars on supplying arms, and all the way to such powers as Great Britain and related stakeholders that for hundreds of years have dreamt of routing Russia, be that the Russian Empire, the Soviet Union, or the Russian Federation. They would like to get at its vast resources, mineral resources, and human resources. They would like to remove Russia from the map as a global player. And these people are still there, they exist, and to them, it's a good war. Every day of this war is profitable because it every day deals a certain blow to Russia. What happens to Ukraine and its citizens is something these people do not care about. What matters to them is reaching their own goals and making money in terms of big pharma or the military defense complex. It's billions. We're talking about billions. And I'm afraid that Mr. Trump will have a hard time pushing back against this lobby.
Well, I also think that with Trump's new effort, and that is, I am going to not just punish Russia, I'm going to go after India and Brazil and South Africa and China, because I'm going to tell them they're not allowed to be friends with Russia. I think that's going to backfire. I think what it's going to do, and we'll see. Just today, Mr. Trump announced a new tariff on India. I think what it's going to do is bring those countries closer together and make him stronger. I think he's making a mistake, but we'll see. Thank you so much, sir, for coming on. Colonel, it's a pleasure. Thank you for giving us your wisdom and all your experiences that most people would never know about, but you did. So thank you once again.
I would like to forget some of my experiences, but unfortunately, it's here to stay with me forever.
Well said. Well said. And that's it for us. This has been the Sanchez Effect. I thank you for taking time to share with us and to let us bring you some of the exclusive information that we're able to get for you. And I'll share much of this on Journalistically Speaking. As you know, I have a YouTube channel. It's a podcast, and you can find it there as well on Journalistically Speaking. And you can find me on X at Rick Sanchez TV. We'll be looking for you next time. Good night.